Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
In this episode, Ilona sits down with Paul Michael of Peter Michael Winery.
Mm-hmm. Who had been working before, I think, at Phelps here in mm-hmm. California, but not for very long. And he joined us hardly speaking English. And improve the wine, don't change the style, and learn English. And but he's actually he's taken the whole portfolio to another level, in my opinion, making some of the most beautiful wines we've ever made. Well, and that's been well recognized by the critics mm-hmm. as well. And he's added, so one of the early things he did was add Eau Paradis to the portfolio as well. Okay. So that was one of his first projects. Although I correct myself, because he actually made the first Pinot Noirs from the Sonoma Coast. So we planted in 06 and Nick joined us in early 06. That's when he joined us. So yes. So he has added hugely to the program of what we do, and that continues today too.
You know, go ahead.
No, I think we should try this yes. Sauvignon Blanc. We have a glass of Après Midi 2014, which is a great vintage, and this is actually growing in the Le Pabot vineyard. Mm-hmm. It's in the various parts of the vineyard there. It is a Sauvignon Blanc with a blend of a small amount of Semillon. Mm-hmm. And that'll vary from vintage to vintage, anywhere between 5% and I think up to 12%. Mm-hmm. Up to 14% recently, I think.
14%.
14% is the highest we've done. And so, yeah, we want to try and, it depends on each vintage as to how much that of Semillon it requires. Mm-hmm. So it's a Bordeaux-inspired white wine, clearly. In the first few years, it was 100% Sauvignon Blanc, and it was when Luke joined us that he added the Semillon. And it's called Après Midi because it's a Sauvignon Blanc you can drink any time of the afternoon, from lunch onwards.
It's a dangerous Sauvignon Blanc because I have been not only myself enamored with it, but it's a reference point for a lot of people of California Sauvignon Blanc. And again, in that spirit of, you're not about trendy, you're about being the trend. You're about really setting forth a philosophy that produces wines that are incredibly beautiful and elegant, but also so darn delicious that I have gone through a bottle of this while working. I probably should edit that out. But that's how really compelling it is to my palate. And this is a 14, which is a huge treat. I don't get to taste library Sauvignon Blancs from your brand, so thank you for that. I just
okay.
want to salute you and you.
Cheers.
Cheers. Good health. Good health, yeah.
Absolutely, good health. Wow. Again, savory, that word minerally that we debated for a while. Mm-hmm. Really beautiful lemon blossom, a lot of really subtle citrus and floral components. What I really love about this wine as well is the texture. It has this really yep. silky mouthfeel.
Yes.
And the finish on all your wines. But, you know, Sauvignon Blanc, we talked about before the recording, is that sometimes it just doesn't get enough love. It becomes a stepchild in people's minds because it's not as important as some of the red and other white varieties. But you've made a Sauvignon Blanc with so much personality and character. Well,
thank you. Stories from the road. I think one of the regular stories from the road as such is when this is poured, and this features in most wine dinners, their reaction is, wow, this is, I thought I didn't like Sauvignon Blanc, but I'm loving this. And it's got a sort of complexity and a sort of gastronomic quality to it that you expect from the Chardonnay. And so you have Chardonnay drinkers coming and enjoying this. And
now this is really my extreme pleasure to taste the library wine that is so young and fresh. You know, again, I am continuously impressed with your commitment to integrity and quality across the portfolio. And now that I've learned that you make, I've always known it was extensive, but you said 7 wines per release?
Yeah.
So 7 or 8, depends.
7 or 8, so yeah. that's quite a lot to manage, but they're all so incredibly different and have their own personality, their own storyline, and very worth getting to know.
We make 15 different wines, don't we?
Yeah. Exactly.
Total. So this is great. I think the important thing about this is it's growing. You know, you can make Sauvignon Blanc in many places, but this is growing in great terroir. It's perhaps because we're Brits and we love our Sauvignon Blanc, and you know, a good stable diet of Baronelle and La Doucette is what I remember, and which is Loire Valley. You know, Sauvignon Blanc, but. I think we wanted a Sauvignon Blanc in our portfolio. And normally where this is planted, you would plant, for good economic reasons, a Cabernet Sauvignon, or Merlot or Cabernet Franc. But we put a few acres aside and make this. We make about 2,000 cases of this wine.
That's still tiny. You mentioned you were in 15 countries, and that may be a better question for you, Peter.
Is 15 wines.
15 wines,
15
and then
wines.
You have 15 different export markets that you work with. Is there any markets that specifically have fans of a varietal, like some of them are more partial to Cabs and some perhaps gravitate more towards Chardonnay?
I haven't noticed that.
No,
I've got to confess.
It's really
quite
balanced across the board.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
We do have a couple of states that are inordinately fond of the Sauvignon Blanc, actually. Hawaii and Massachusetts.
That's quite a spread.
Well, Hawaii, because, you know, it's
obvious reasons.
Summer there all the time.
Yes,
it goes really well with fish.
Warmer states.
And an enormous amount of L'Après-Midi that goes to Massachusetts ends up on the island of Nantucket.
Ah, now it's making a lot more sense.
Right, exactly.
And it goes really well with Nantucket-based scallops, I'll tell you that
personally.
Of course,
seafood, yes. Mm-hmm. And how's the Asian market? How is it different from others?
What I was going to say is you would expect... what I was going to say was you find people know us because of our Chardonnays.
Yeah.
But often... like 50-50, you know, 50% of the time, people come to me and say, oh, I'm looking forward to this evening, I know your reds, you know, I love Le Pavot, but I'm looking forward to discovering your whites.
That's really interesting.
I've never had them, so it's 50-50. And sort of related to that, in Asia, you would expect with Asian food, a preference for the whites.
Of course, yeah.
But I don't know that, you know, that is the case in Asia. I haven't really remarked upon that. I think.
Well, I think the collector community is inordinately focused on red wine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the people that know our wine in Asia are very serious collectors.
Yeah, of course.
So those two things just seem to dovetail.
Yeah.
And you also support several charitable foundations, correct? So people might want to look that up if they're really curious about it.
Yeah, we do. We have the principal activity there is the Peter Michael Foundation.
Of course.
In Europe we have the Pelican Foundation as well, mm-hmm. which is we've been part of supporting. The Peter Michael Foundation is our own foundation, and it supports research into the detection and treatment of prostate cancer.
Wow, and such a common and devastating
Well, that's right, and really until quite recently been an underfunded, under-recognized cancer and cancer research requirement. And so we've been doing that for, well, a number of years, 20 years probably in mm-hmm. total, between our activities in the UK and the Peter Michael Foundation here. And so, you know, we will classically, we typically will look for sort of the high risk, high reward opportunities and research mm-hmm. projects out there, mm-hmm. Which are not going to attract the big funding, government funding, etc.
Going against the grain.
So,
not the easy.
Well, it's important. So that you know these researchers, that's what they you need that gap, that funding gap to substantiate a theory, and so we work with, for example, we work with the UC at San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Dr. Larry Fong, looking at immunology treatments, and these projects are generating very good results, very encouraging results, and so it's rather than well, first of all, why prostate cancer? But prostate cancer is as I said, it was under recognized and underfunded. But it's also the advances you can make in prostate cancer, such a complicated cancer. What you can learn there, you can then apply to other cancers as well. And so it's one of the more challenging parts of the body for many, many reasons.
Yeah. Well, again, if you guys didn't feel good about drinking wines already, if you didn't have enough reasons, there's one more, because you're doing a lot of good.
Thank you, and we do hold events up here at the winery for that, and around the U.S.
Okay.
So the Peter Michael Foundation has its separate website,
and
we do kind of foundation events, friends events, sort of paired with Peter Michael wines. And the biggest event is up here in the summertime, generally.
Okay.
And, yeah.
So go on the website, Peter Michael.
It's another way to come and visit us.
Yes.
And come and get to know us. That's
fantastic.
For sure.
Wow. So what is the next wine that we're going to taste, and what is the story behind that one?
So the next wine is Les Pavots. Les Pavots means poppies. The Californian poppy, the orange poppy state flower.
Yeah.
It's growing here.
And
it's on the label. And to my point on that, you know, you can look across the room from a long way away and you spot that red poppy. Or it's a gold poppy on the whites. Mm-hmm. You're familiar with the brand. Instant recognition. That was really important. It's an understated label, very simple label in many ways with the poppy. And that poppy, that's where it comes from. It's the Californian poppy
yes.
that grows up here in the springtime, makes the vineyards look beautiful. And
mm-hmm.
And Les Pavots was that wine, you know, that my father had in his mind at the beginning. A claret from California,
mm-hmm.
Which is probably an oxymoron because it's California and you're not going to make a claret,
mm-hmm.
but you can make an elegant, elegant, balanced, classical Bordeaux blend, and that's what Les Pavots is. And so it's roughly 2/3 Cabernet Sauvignon, or roughly 65%. Cabernet Sauvignon, and then Cabernet Franc, and a little bit of Merlot on a typical year. And we've added Petit Verdot quite a long time ago. We've had Petit Verdot in this blend for many, many years. So it's a classical blend.
This wine definitely is highly cerebral and at the same time hedonistic. That's
mm-hmm.
how it always landed on me in this particular vintage. That's 2015 we're trying, is no exception. It has remarkable stamina. As I'm talking, I'm sort of subconsciously counting the seconds in my head of the finish because it's quite long. But the wine, I know 2015 for most was a rather short vintage, but rather concentrated one. Was that the case for you as well? Was the yield down in that vintage?
15 was a relatively small vintage.
Okay.
If I'm recalling correctly, Bloom and Sap were a little bit problematic, so that cut the crop size down to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the produced wines for a lot of folks that are very good at what they do and make great wines, it was the vintage that was definitely a standout. Came on the heel of 14. That was also noted for quality, but 15 was, I think, for many producers, very, very short crop, but very notable. And this wine definitely deserves its own separate conversation. I think it deserves its own podcast. I have to have a conversation with it.
Well, it's growing on the hillside here. The vineyard starts at about 800 feet and goes up to 1,200 feet. It's a 60-acre site, and so we make more of this wine than anything else. So we make about 3,000 cases of this wine,
which is still tiny.
Pointing
it out.
Yeah, it's still because, small. It's all small production here, but so we make about 3,000 cases. Mm-hmm. We make it actually has a second wine called Esprit de Pavot that also comes from the vineyard as well, which is a more of a freestyle blend, different expression from the same vineyard. And we'll make sort of 1,000 to 1,500 cases of that.
Mm-hmm.
But this is, you are looking in, it's protected by that ridge that we're on, and there's another ridge at the side.
Mm-hmm.
So it's protected, it's warmer than the Chardonnay vineyards up above, which are right next to here, but just higher. You can look into Napa Valley, the north end of Napa Valley, from this vineyard, and yet we're here in Sonoma, so this is a Sonoma Cabernet blend, and it's mountain fruit, and so you've got some, you've got some, being mountain fruit, you've got a backbone of great acidity, you've got actually a minerality in there again, it's a different kind of minerality, but it's there, and you've got it's a blueberry signature and
gorgeous fruit.
A garrigue, sort of herbal notes in there as well. And those are the signatures of this wine year in, year out.
Yeah, the fruit is absolutely remarkable. And like you pointed out, the acidity, the framework, it's so significant that, again, to reiterate, it's an event, so you can plan your life around it. Well worth it. I can't even imagine what it would be like out of a large format down the road.
Good. Very good. We've got a few of those sitting around.
Those of you that collect large formats, I know that every time I ask a question, there's a different tack that people take as far as the explanation as to why the wine sells better. I'm not sure if you have a theory on that, but are you as far as why large formats seem to sell better than...
Well, we'll go with what Nick Morlay, our winemaker, says.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Nick really relates it to the relationship between the oxygen permeating the cork and the volume of wine in the bottle. Mm-hmm. That bigger formats basically are less exposed to oxidation because there's just so much more volume in the bottle.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. That's probably the most common response, and I'm glad that your winemaker feels that way. And it's a huge incentive to purchase large formats. It's certainly a great sharing opportunity and pressing people that, hopefully you like. But even if you don't, you're going to make friends.
I think this wine benefits from a few years in the bottle for sure.
Yes.
As well.
The structure is remarkable. Yeah. And there's this tension, the energy that you can sense as you're tasting it. So there's almost this juxtaposition of really plush, big fruit that's voluminous without being weighty.
Yeah.
And this energy and tension that's happening on your palate that I find quite remarkable.
Yeah. Well, good. Thank you.
I really hate to say goodbye to this wine. Trust me, it's not easy. I'm having separation anxiety already. but we have one more to taste.
We do.
So
you can come back to that.
Good.
In fact,
thank you.
Really, these two wines should be drunk together and compare, because they are, so the next one is Eau Paradis, and it's our Napa Oakville vineyard. And so to be able to taste these two wines together, you're tasting from the same stylistic approach, mm-hmm. but two different regions of California, and you know, albeit only, what, I don't know, 30 miles away. Not very far, but probably less than that. But this is, so Eau Paradis is the vineyard we purchased. It was originally Choquette, the Choquette vineyard.
Oh, wow, that's quite a famous site.
So this is exactly, and we'd been looking for a while, and so we were in the right place at the right time. And so it bought its neighbor's Dalla Valley, mm-hmm. and it sits at sort of 600 feet altitude overlooking Napa Valley on the eastern side of Oakville. Mm-hmm. It's got that famous red dirt that Oakville's known for. And it's basically got a Napa cab here, but it's a blend. It's 76% Cabernet Sauvignon and 24% Cabernet Franc, and reflecting the vines in that on that property. And enjoy.
Thank you. I mean, 24% Cab Franc, that's a pretty hefty dosage. Typically, Cab Franc is smaller ratio to Cabernet Sauvignon, and I mean, what's typical? It's just not as common for me to find a large component of Cab Franc, and there's nothing like a good Cab Franc. If it's good, it's really good.
Well, Nick loves the Cabernet Franc that grows there. He, you know, very much so. And he calls this wine the Beethoven, and he calls them Le Pavé Mozart, to kind of capture the different style. No, well, it's not the different style, but the different profile of what you got in the glass there. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely more masculine,
yes.
more meaty.
Yes.
You know, you've got that fruit forwardness that you expect from a Napa wine, from an Oakville mm-hmm. wine, for sure. This will drink younger, more easily.
Mm-hmm. And a bit more of an herbal component, dry herb.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which I really love.
Indeed. Tobacco.
Yep.
For sure. And
baking spice, maybe.
Yes. Yeah. Savory.
Savory.
Very much savory.
Sure.
Savory profile there. And you know, this again, this will, Nick says 20 to 30 years, this will go.
Heartily agreed, not that you have the patience, or at least I don't, to wait that long.
So we purchased the vineyard in 2009. Mm-hmm. We thought we were ready to go, and so we thought our first vineyard would be 2010, but it wasn't. We were caught out. You have to pay your dues to a new site. Mm-hmm. So we were caught out there, hadn't left enough cover, and there was a heat spike. We hadn't got our irrigation, you know, properly sorted out there. So our first vintage was 2011. Huh. And, well...
Difficult.
Hmm?
Difficult vintage for many.
Yes. Made a beautiful wine from there.
Thank God.
We had, in the meantime, removed 10,000 tons of rock to give the vines better, you know, mm-hmm. area for root, for their roots, and for drainage, better drainage, and improve the irrigation. We couldn't remove the rock; we had to crush it all on site, and so we have the most beautiful vineyard roads spread out throughout the vineyard there. We then had that wine in the bottle for quite a while without a name, because we got, as I said, 15 wines. This is the 15th wine, and we the family name, they come up with a name, and we welcome suggestions, but you know, it's our prerogative, and but we couldn't agree on a name for this wine, and you know, my father had ideas, and we had ideas, and it's got to be an original name, it's got to be a story behind it, it's got to be pronounceable in English. And anyway, we were every year we go up in the vineyards here, in fact, and above the vineyards there's a sort of hill on the top of the property here where we have our foundation events, And we go up there on the Perseid, which is the night of the 12th of August. At 2 a.m., you get the shooting stars peak. You know, the Perseid builds up over sort of over late July and through early August. And you can count one shooting star a minute at 2 a.m. in the morning on the 12th, which we got this wrong before. It is the night of the 11th, if you think about it. But so we go up there and we drink plenty of this wine, or these wines, I should say. Kids have those things you like to call s'mores, an American delicacy. And then you know, you fall asleep, and you wake up after, you always do after a little bit too much good wine, and you wake up in the middle of the night and you can count these shooting stars and then slowly fall back to sleep. It's like counting sheep. So we did that, and when our youngest son was five, he woke us up way too early in the morning, and it was broad daylight, fog had come in, and he was looking out across the fog, across the clouds, at little islands, and he was floating on an island. And so he said, "Mom and Dad, wake up, we've woken up in heaven." Aww. And which is just a lovely, lovely little moment, you know, and a lot of cooing and all that, as you do. A few years go by, and we've got this wine in the bottle with no name, and the same event, you know, happens, and Emily wakes up and says, "Right, Paul, we've got a, we were there with some French friends, and he said, Paul, we've just got to send a short list of names down to the winery. Let's write the short list of French names," mm-hmm. and signed it off on her little iPhone, still in a sleeping bag. Paul, Emily, and the kids up in heaven. And then she asked her, how do you say in heaven in French? And the answer to that, as our French friends confirmed, was, and I knew this too, it's Au Paradis.
Wow.
And we looked at each other and said, that is a great name for a bottle of wine. So that's where the Au Paradis name comes from. In paradise or in heaven. And, you know, as we were saying earlier, we love people to come here and visit the property and visit this place, this little paradise that we have here. And it's never mind the wine, it's a beautiful property with the mountain backdrop and the creek running all the way through it and a lot of wildlife. It's great to see, you know. We're going to go to see it.
Well, you know, for folks that know you from the press accolades and, you know, all the love that you received over the years from official sources and the remarkable wines that you've crafted, I feel like you really lead with your heart, first and foremost.
Absolutely. Yes. passion and heart. Absolutely. We love this place. And I think it's we love the people here. You know, it's one big family here. There's 50 people working here every day, in one form or other. And we come here, and we always get a fantastic welcome. And my father, it's his favourite place, I think. He comes and relaxes here. Sadly, my mother doesn't come here these days, but she used to love it too. And this has been part of my adult life throughout, and it's been part of my kids' life all through, and we'll keep working on that 100 by 100 plan.
It is so very special, you know. Wines are important, and the sentiment, and all the remarkable amount of work and intent and thought and expense that goes into it is important, but above all is really that human interaction. I've believed for many years that wine mimics human experience, and that's why there's such an intense emotional connection that people develop. And this is a showcase of that sentiment as we tasted through the wines and learned from your stories. It became quite obvious that this is not just a long-term, 100-year plan, but that's something that you live out every day with everything that you do, and it permeates your every thought and every act. And that, to me, is the most precious and valuable thing of all.
And an important part of terroir is the other people, is man.
That's right, human terroir.
Human terroir.
What is your vision for the future for Peter Michael? What does that look like? More of what you're doing, or maybe some more plans?
Yeah, well, I think really the vision for the future has been for the foreseeable future, because that's as far as we can see, right?
Yeah.
And keep it in our family hands. You know, we're the guardians of what we're doing here and what's going on here. And then I think the foreseeable future has really been sealed with the fact that we've purchased this vineyard behind us, up above us, and we're budding over, and it's a small expansion, but it's an important expansion, and makes all the difference to the availability of our wine.
Do you have any thoughts? You've now observed the scene in Napa and conversely Sonoma and probably other wine countries as well, but mostly since we're here in Napa. What in your view has changed, or how have things evolved in Napa Valley? Do you have any philosophical thoughts as to the larger community, wine community of Napa?
Gosh, that's a big question.
I know, it's huge.
Right?
Isn't it?
That's a huge question. And Napa and Sonoma, you're talking about.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
Like, what's geographically relevant?
Yeah. Press pause.
Yep, no problem.
Okay. So I think that, you know, firstly, I think the region's went through a trauma.
Yes, very much so.
Nearly 2 years ago, with the October fires,
mm-hmm.
and of course since then there have been further events nearby as well. So, I think that's this is idyllic paradise.
Yeah.
Who actually we could have introduced him.
Oh, we can still do that. That's totally possible.
Want to go and get him?
Yeah. Of course.
He's kind of wandered in.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. I love spontaneity.
Yeah.
You know, as you were talking about what a paradise Napa is, and
are you recording?
Yeah.
Okay, we're recording. Okay.
Yeah. So.
So let me carry on. So, so I think this is an idyllic paradise. People believe it, see it as an idyllic paradise, and it is. It's just the most beautiful, unspoilt area, we've always described it as a kind of an oasis. Even in California, I mean, California is a wonderful state, but
it is,
within California, it's an oasis, and the fires that came through recently kind of unsettled that and made everybody realize, gosh, you know, the forces of nature can change everything overnight, and they've changed a lot of people's, I guess, psychological
makeup,
living around here. And and that all comes down to a support.
Yes.
So, you know, we and many other wineries recognize the importance to support communities that have been affected by that and continue to do that. As well, and then we know what we'll get on to climate change in a minute. But we've just had a spontaneous
new arrival. I'm very excited.
Interruption. Welcome, interruption. Hi, Harv.
How are you?
Good to see you, sir. So, Harv is.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
Very nice to meet you. I understand you've been here quite a while. I heard 28 years. Is that
28 years, Fiaro.
Wow.
For back memory.
28 years, Harv, exactly.
28 years, start basically with the family. Back in 91.
Wow.
You know, so
and then we were farming 60 acres? Or
In that time, 14 to 16 acres in old Cabernet Varietal.
40, did you say 14 to 16?
Yes.
That's small, right, exactly.
Yeah, it's only actually by the vineyard shop right now in that section there, really flat. There's half the Bellcoat basically opened the land there and basically Le Pavot, but actual vines in the ground is only
16 acres. Yeah. And now since then you've planted.
Now she's with a new vineyard, Vineyard 9, probably now 150 in the Knights Valley, 20 acres in Oakville, and 20 acres in Seaview and Pinot Noirs.
I think it's really quite a serendipity. We're just talking about what a paradise Napa is, and you know, obviously the vineyards that we're talking about in Fort Worth, Seaview. I mean, I again joke that God had a really good day when he made that particular piece of land. The stewardship piece of it, the fact that somebody has to be very cognizant and conversely very busy, it's a lot of hard work to actually manage it and preserve it. And here you are walking in, and it was like a sign.
It's pretty, you know, hard work, but at the same time, you know, it's, you know, always saying many times is Paul here, but working with the family and definitely for it with Sir Peter and Michael, I mean, this.
It's very special.
It's really special. This really motivate, you know, this.
Yeah.
I always came with the conversations when I'm talking with him to say, you know, I still remember when I give you a tour with Mark Albert, you know, he say to us, the only thing I'm looking for is 4,000 cases so I can drink with my family and friends, and I can, and if it is possible, do I can make a little bit of money. I always remember him, you know, when I'm be, you know, alone, and I say, sir, it's 25,000 cases, and it's not stopped yet. But it's really nice, I mean, working with the family and find those special properties, because this is what it is, you know, Knights Valley. I mean, Knights Valley, you know, in the background to Salina Mountain. I mean, you know, now how this looks, you know, first the Cabernet, then after that, the Chardonnay. I mean, and growing basically three different varietals in the same property with, of course, there's different elevations in Knights and Chardonnay. You know.
Absolutely, no, there's so much variety, and I'm sure every day is a challenge.
Every day is a challenge, yes, I mean, but you know, there's always this welcome.
But you look happy, and I know how much you're valued. We've talked extensively about the people factor, the human terroir, people that make all of this possible. And I just want to thank you so much for your hard work. I've been a lucky recipient of tasting the delicious wines that were put together originating from your hard work.
Well, it's enjoyable to work with it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Harv.
Okay,
yeah.
Thanks.
See you later.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I was getting on to climate change, and I'm not a climatologist or an expert in any sense, but obviously everybody's, especially this year it seems, have become far, far more aware on a worldwide basis. And accepting, generally, and you know, I think that the those events of nearly 2 years ago and last year are, you know, part of that. And but I think that the wine is a very, very visible, winemaking is a very visible expression of climate change.
Yes.
And and how to react to it, and you know, wine is something that everybody, almost everybody in the world, comes into contact with, and if it if the character of wine changes, that will make it very, very visible. And
absolutely.
So the wine industry as a whole, and Napa and Sonoma are part of that, are and need to be cognizant of that, and it's, we're a very visible part of that whole event,
yes.
Really.
Well, thank you very much for your generous hospitality, and certainly for being such a remarkable steward as a brand of the land that you treat with such care and thoughtfulness, and of course for your philanthropy, and for really being a beacon in many ways and a reference point for what good things, pleasurable things, intellectual things, stimulating and spiritual and inspiring things are all about.
Thank you, Alona.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palette Exposure featuring Alona Thompson. We'll see you again next week.